The Home Show with Sinead Ryan on News Talk.
Hello and you're very welcome along to the latest episode in the Home Show podcast. I'm your host, Sinead Ryan. Coming up this week. Now, we've been told repeatedly that listed or protected buildings on RTÉ's campus have seemingly devalued the property towards a potential sale. But what are those listed buildings and why are they such an issue? What furnishings could be avoided if you have an allergy? Should you become a director of the management company in your building? And we look back on the flamboyantly stylish life of interior designer Iris Apfel. If you'd like to get involved in our podcast, you can contact us during the week at thehomeshow@newstalk.com, or you can find me over on Instagram at SineadRyan100. And if you've missed any of the elements, of course, they are all up on this podcast, which can be searched on the Newstalk app or on newstalk.com. Well, now, March is indeed a busy month this year. We celebrated a lovely Mother's Day last weekend. Well, unless you're the Princess of Wales, that is. And what a palaver that turned out to be, all over one photograph. We have Easter in a couple of weeks. And for now, it is, of course, St. Patrick's Day tomorrow. And I couldn't bring myself, unfortunately, to do a segment on the 40 shades of green. It's not a colour that I particularly like in my house. So perhaps instead I might ask you how you're decorating your home, if you are, for St. Patrick's Day. Is it all green, white and orange bells and whistles, or just a tasteful bowl of shamrock a la the White House? Well, we'll all be getting on green this afternoon as we watch Ireland take on Scotland in the Aviva in the final match of the Six Nations. And for me, that's the shade of green that I can get on board with. If you want to get in touch with us today, you can text us on 53106. You can email us at thehomeshow@newstalk.com. And you'll find me on Instagram, SineadRyan100. And you're very welcome along to The Home Show.
I wanted to look at all options. We had the site valued by Savills, who did the valuation for us on the last piece of land we sold. And their valuation
that
came...
That was nine acres for 107 million.
Yeah. Yeah, and they came back and said, I'm afraid it's significantly less than you might imagine. It's 100 million. Now, part of the reason is we have four or five listed buildings on there, which severely impact on the value of the land. We also have the mast on there, as people know. So it's not an attractive piece of land for developers.
Now, that was RTÉ Director General Kevin Backhurst speaking to Ciara Kelly on News Talk Breakfast about the proposal to sell off some of the RTÉ campus back in November. You'll remember then and now, RTÉ was in something of a financial crisis and it was mooted as a topic. But with questions about the ongoing crisis still rumbling on, what exactly is it about the listed buildings on the Montrose campus that make it such an unattractive proposition for developers? Well, Ian Lumley is Heritage Officer at Ontashka and joins me now. Ian, you're very welcome along to The Home Show. Now, let's start with the listed or protected structures on the RTÉ campus. It's safe to say it's a bit of a mishmash design-wise.
Well, in fact, the opposite is the case.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Tell me.
It is indeed a very distinguished example of 20th century design by one of the leading Irish architects, Ronnie Tallon, who joined the very distinguished architect Michael Scott, who is best remembered for Bozzaris, forming what became the firm of Scott Tallon Walker when Robin Walker joined. And there was great vision when the Montrose House site was acquired for integrating the newly established Irish television service and the existing radio service on a single campus. Interestingly, the house that they acquired, Montrose House, and the grounds on which the campus was built, was the home of the radio inventor's mother, Marconi.
Oh, right. Wow, interesting.
Just by a quirky
coincidence. And of course, we're in Marconi House now, which is the name of Newstalk's building that it's housed. So
Marconi had both an Irish mother and he married an Irish woman.
That's extraordinary.
And of course, had huge connections with Ireland because of the development of the radio station in Valentia in Kerry. But to get back to RTÉ, there was great vision when Ronnie Tallon took on the brief for developing the complex in 1960 and further in 1963 after the television building was commissioned. There was a unified master plan laid out on a grid. Tallon was very much inspired by one of the great architects of the 20th century, the German Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, whose major work was in Chicago and New York in the mid 20th century. with a great concern for geometric proportion, for elegance, and for following a mathematically defined grid. So everything on the RTE campus was laid out to a 20-foot grid. So in modules of 20, 40, 80 feet.
Okay, and that gave it as a kind of a symmetry then.
So the buildings have a great unity. But the buildings, there are five of these mid-20th century buildings that are listed. The television building, which people will be very familiar with. Mm-hmm. Anybody who's attended a Late Late Show audience, and a lot of interviews are done outside the building. You see it all the time on TV. Others that are less seen, the one for the scenery storage in behind, the staff restaurant building, the administration building, and the radio building, which is a very fine piece of work, very much reflecting the quality of the Illinois Institute of Technology campus, which is considered one of the Mies van der Rohe complex of buildings that influence Ronnie Talon. Also, there was great ingenuity in the design, because the television centre building was designed, and indeed the scene dock and the others were designed to be extendable, built in a modular form, so that
you could add on a bit.
You could add on in phases as more capacity was needed. So it's a very fine and well considered architectural legacy of the early. Of the mid-20th century, and indeed won a gold medal from the Royal Institute of Architects of Ireland for the television building.
Okay, and for all that though, Ian, like, you know, it was a moment in time, and I suppose like all great architecture, reflected that time. Some might say it's not the prettiest of campuses though.
It represents an aesthetic of the time.
When I say somebody, I'm thinking of me. I mean, you referenced Bazaars there because, of course, that was also another great building. And again, you know, people might think a little bit of brutalism going on there, and clunky and concrete. And I wouldn't consider it elegant, maybe, in the way that you would appreciate.
Well, there are features that are elegant. If you look at the television building, it has a very fine curved concrete staircase running from the
The entrance area. It's absolutely beautiful inside.
I think it's fair to describe that as that is elegant. But there's a finesse to the slender steel and concrete columns that form the basis of the structure. And also, it's a building designed around its function, very much a purpose-built complex with very specific functions, which have aged very well in terms of its continued use and operation.
And it's still being used. Now, what does it mean generally for a building to be listed or protected? What responsibility does that confer, and what does it preclude you from doing?
Well, being a protected structure under planning legislation, this is the current 2000 Planning Act we're operating under. So the RTE campus, or at least five of the buildings, along with the 19th century Jemison family house, Montrose House.
Yeah, and that was the one I was referring to when I thought there's a mishmash style, because there's an old, very elegant, which I've been in, house there. It's not used for much internally, as far as I know. It's not particularly nice inside, but it is a beautiful outside.
It's a very attractive house, and it was in the grounds of that house that the complex was built. So all of them, along with our architectural heritage legacy around the country, from country houses, from the squares and streets of George and Dublin, or Limerick, or the quays of Cork, all of these are protected structures, which means that they've been identified as buildings of special character because of their design, construction, history, or other significance, and that any planning application to alter them needs to be subject to consideration that reflects that, and demolition should only be considered in exceptional circumstances.
Okay.
For example, there was a Georgian house demolished on the site of the Dublin Airport Terminal, and that was deemed to be an exceptional circumstance.
Okay, because of
just
what
to accommodate
remained.
That airport terminal.
Now, in 2017, there was a deal done with Cairn Homes to sell a plot of RT land, 107 million. It went for far over the guide price. And the plan was for hundreds and hundreds of apartments. I think they got the hotel they planned next, but there was hundreds of other apartments built. And it included, as far as I know, one protected structure, which was Mount Errol House. But they're going ahead. They got permission. They're working around it. I mean, would it not be possible to extend that to other aspects of the campus if it was agreed to sell it? I mean, it's very valuable location-wise.
Well, the Cairn house lands that were sold off by RTE apart from Merrill House were largely undeveloped.
Okay.
So it was very much a retrenching by RTE of its land holdings. So the remaining land that RTE holds is substantially occupied by buildings and car park areas.
So Kevin Backhurst is right then. I mean, a developer isn't going to touch that with a barge pole, are they?
Very much so, because the buildings are purpose-built. It's hard to see what alternative use there could be. Educational campus might be the most obvious.
A university one. Or something like that.
But the question is, where would RTE go then?
Yeah.
And if you look at the big television and radio transmitter mast that is directly integrated then with the complex.
Of course, and the mast itself it would be obviously have to be moved somewhere. Ian, is it the case that like you could consider some of those buildings an exceptional circumstance, or is that something at Antashka that you would absolutely not want to see and demolish them?
The general principle is that any building, once a protected structure, we should be looking at maintaining it for future generations because of its special interest. And it's only a very small number of buildings, both in Dublin and nationally, that have from the mid and late 20th century that have been scheduled for protection.
Okay.
And this is really a complex of buildings that stands out and that shows the influence in Ireland of the international movement, and particularly of the architect Mies van der Rohe in the mid-20th century. The other one would be the former Bank of Ireland in Baker Street, also designed by Ronnie Tallon.
Okay. And then finally, I mean, look, you know, hopefully we've a new chair in now. Kevin Backhurst has turned up to, you know, recover the fortunes or at least turn around RTE's finances. If it ended up being a zero-sum game, and there has been some suggestion that, you know, it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that RTE could not survive. I mean, what are you left with then if it's not this purpose-built building? Where does that place it in terms of, would you just conserve it like a museum then of these buildings?
Well, there might be some argument for a Museum of Irish broadcasting and part of the complex, but these are buildings designed for a particular functional use. So if RTE were to relocate or downsize, it would be desirable to find new uses for the buildings that would be compatible with their character.
All right. For
educational use would seem to be the most obvious one, because residential office conversion wouldn't suit most of the buildings.
Okay, right. Well, listen, there we leave it. It's very interesting and it's been a fascinating discussion. Next time I go into the campus, into Montrose, I will perhaps look on the buildings with a more sympathetic eye after that. Ian Lumley, Heritage Officer at Antashka. Thanks a million for joining us on
Thank
the
you.
Home Show. Did you know about a third of Irish people suffer from some form of allergy, and a very large proportion of those people are susceptible to dust, pollen or mould? So how can we mitigate these factors in the home so that our furnishings don't contribute to our symptoms? Well, Joyce Clegg is Managing Director of the Allergy Clinic and joins me now. You're very welcome along, Joyce.
Lovely. Thanks for having me, Sinead. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, we mentioned the three there, the pollen, the dust mites and the mould. It sounds to me that, you know, people get terrible symptoms. I know around springtime, summertime, when all the pollen is out and all the bees are doing their business and the flowers are blooming, that it can be miserable for people who have allergies to pollen. But it can also be brought into the home very easily. So talk to me a little bit about what we can do about pollen, because it is an outdoor substance, but it can be dragged in around the house.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose we don't really think about it. We think about, you know, when we think about a grass pollen allergy, or indeed a tree allergy, or as you say, an outdoor allergy, we never really consider what happens when we bring that into the home, or that we do bring that into the home. Obviously, when we're outdoors and we pick up these allergens on our clothes, on our body, on ourselves, we walk into our home, which we hope and believe is our safe haven and our safe space, and all of a sudden we're miserable. Like we're symptomatic, we've runny nose, we've blocked noses, we're feeling stuffed up. We're like, oh my God, what's happening now? Like, I'm feeling just as bad as I was when I was out there with the grass as I am inside my own home. So you're right. What we're doing is we're actually bringing the pollen into the house. So the measures that we would advise our patients if they are diagnosed with a grass pollen allergy is to, when you come in your front door, go directly to your bathroom, remove your clothes, have a shower, wash your face, that kind of thing.
Gosh.
Get into your indoor clothes. Now, I know, you know,
most of us wouldn't even like taking off our shoes at the door.
Exactly. But I think we do, you know, we love getting into our jammies, you know, when we come home from wherever we've been. But it's to kind of make that a habit or a ritual or routine that you do have those indoor clothes that are not outside.
And you're not dragging it around with you.
You're not bringing it through the whole house.
And can pollen transfer then, like, onto soft furnishings?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, another tip is don't open your windows in the summer. Now, I know it's very difficult because we're warm and we're stuffed in. But maybe if you have a vent on your window, open the vent. Don't necessarily swing those windows open, you know, when you're there.
And if you have pets, can pets drag in pollen as well? Because, of course, we know dogs like to go and cats like to go rooting in all sorts of, of interesting places, let's say, in the garden.
Absolutely. And so should they. So should they. So, yeah, that's another thing. So what we would suggest is that when you come in with your pet after them being out or out walking, is to have, like, at your front, in my own home, I have a little cloth that hangs at the front door, a nice little kind of little glove that we have at the front door. And, like, we just wipe our dog down when she comes in, a little damp it off, a little bit of a spray, wipe it down and wipe her paws. Okay. So it kind of takes off any residual kind of dander or pollen that they've picked up on their lovely time outside.
All right.
So again, then you're not restricting the animal to what we say is the downstairs of the house. I mean, in the allergy clinic, we'll tell you never any animals upstairs, particularly if you have a cat or dog allergy or a dust mite allergy or grass pollen, because you're just, you know, really bringing the trouble up the stairs then.
Okay, so that kind of minimises it coming into the house in the first place. Something we can't do anything about in the house is dust. Now, like, dust is a kind of an overall term, a global term for, like, all kinds of things.
Yeah, like, it really is. I suppose when people think, when our patients come through to the allergy clinic to us, they're like, oh, we can't avoid dust, it's everywhere. It's not actually dust that you're wiping up that we are concerned about. It's actually the dust mite that you're having a response to.
Okay.
To give you a little bit about this little guy, you're going to love this one.
You're going to get yucky now, are you? Oh, okay.
Block your ears. the dust mite is a living, breathing organism. So he's microscopic in size. We don't see him, you know, thankfully. But what he does is he lives in our mattresses predominantly. So when the dust mite is in our mattress at nighttime, when our airways are relaxed, his life goal is to travel up through our airways, down into our lungs, and he defecates in our lungs.
Apologies on a Saturday morning for everybody who is currently in bed. Sipping a coffee.
Oh my goodness, what's happened? What happened to me
yuckity
last night?
Yuck, yuck, yuck. Okay, so let's go straight to how can we stop it doing that?
So very, like, the top measures are to damp dust our homes, and particularly our bedrooms where we're sleeping, or any area in your home that you're sleeping. So if you like to have a nap on your sofa, you know, make that area as clean as possible. So damp dusting, never chemicals, just have a water spray in your home.
That'll do it.
Spray away, and just some kitchen roll or clean cloth, and, you know, remove that dust.
Okay.
In your bedroom, we would always say, you know, if you can avoid curtains, do. Blackout blinds are best. Carpets are always a no-no if you have a dust mite allergy.
And actually also for people sometimes who have asthma.
Yeah.
I know one of my kids definitely had asthma when they were very small. And he couldn't have carpets, curtains or cuddly toys.
Yeah.
And his room looked as if it was like a prison cell compared to his sister's.
Agreed.
Who had bluffed with all this stuff.
Yeah, it is. It is.
It's so what, like being awful parents.
It is for children. And funny enough, my own son is the same. But one of our nurses came up with a super idea a number of years back for moms and for children when she was explaining to the child, the asthmatic child or the eczema child, to have a little box or a crate outside the child's bedroom door, and at night time for the child to put her teddies and her dolls
to
or
bed.
Whatever's to bed outside the room.
Great idea.
So it wasn't removing. It wasn't you can't have. It just means you can't have at nighttime in your space.
Yeah, and likewise with paper, a lot of paper books
everything.
Can go into a sealed box.
Yeah, you have everything that you have. But in particularly with children, it's to keep their room as clean as possible. If they have asthma, eczema, dust mite allergy, you know, the goal there is that when they're sleeping, they have their airways are clear. They can sleep. They get a good night's sleep, and that not waking up in the morning feeling like, you know, I'm exhausted. I have stuffy nose. I've runny eyes. My asthma is bad. I didn't sleep very well. And, you know, parents sometimes do tend to put in like a little comfortable teddy. Here's your comfort teddy. And not knowing that it's actually making the child worse.
OK. So actually, the trick then when you're saying keep things as clean as possible, isn't a ton of chemicals sprayed around the place.
Absolutely
and a,
not.
And a duster blowing dust up into the air.
Yeah.
It's that damp dusting. Very, very simple.
Yeah.
And just make sure that everything's dampened down.
Yeah.
Literally to avoid it.
Just to keep, you know, just to keep. I know it's very difficult. We've all got very busy lives. But to try and just keep on top of that housekeeping regime in as part of your routine.
Yeah.
Now, I know it's easier said than done. We all let it build up. I do myself. Yeah. But if you're, it's okay to, you know, your listeners that aren't allergic. But if you do, you've come in, you've had a test and you've got that definitive diagnosis, these are the measures that will, before you go to the medical step of doctors and, you know, potential immunotherapy and going through the allergy cycle.
It's preventative.
These are just tips to kind of help us live in our homes better.
Okay. Well, Joyce, thanks a million. Now, where can people find out more about the Allergy Clinic?
Super. You can head to our website. We're www.theallergyclinic.ie. We're all over social, so Instagram, Facebook, and certainly you can. We're all over the country. We've Dublin, Cork, Athlone, Galway and Belfast. Right. And we'd love to see
just
you.
Just free
in.
Social
yeah,
media.
Absolutely. We'd love to take care of you.
Joyce Clegg, Managing Director at the Allergy Clinic. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Sinead.
Now, if you've ever owned an apartment, you may have unexpectedly found that you've also unwittingly joined a company. Owners Management Companies, or OMCs, are required in all multi-unit developments, but they remain poorly understood by many of us and even some of those who are on their boards. So what is the role of the management company and should you become a director? Well, you certainly, I think we should all find out a little bit more about them. So to that end, I'm delighted to welcome Aisling Keenan as an Owner Management Company Consultant. And you've written a book and everything, so there's nothing you don't know. You're very welcome along to the Home Show, Aisling.
Thanks very much, Sinead.
Now, let's start with the basics. What is a management company and what does it do?
So an owner's management company is established to vest the common areas of an apartment block in it. And it is established to represent the legal interest of all property owners in the development, in a multi-unit development. It is governed by company law.
OK, so it's mandatory to have it. And in my own case, I live in a mixed estate. So it has houses and it has apartments. And, you know, that creates a certain responsibility, I think, but also rights as owners of properties within that. So tell me a little bit about the responsibilities that the OMC has, because lots of people will know or they'll think maybe of their management company if the lights go out or the place is getting a bit shabby or somebody consistently is parking in the wrong place.
Yeah, of course. And they are the practical day-to-day elements of what the OMC should do for a property owner. And so if you, as you have said there in your introduction, if you buy a unit in a multi-unit development, so an apartment in an apartment block, for example, really it's the responsibility of the solicitor to inform you at the close of sale that you are becoming a member of the management company, because it is automatic when you close the sale of your apartment that you're a member of the management company. And what that means for you is that the management company exists to maintain the building. And so in maintaining the building, then that brings us right down to the practical elements, which is cutting the grass in the common areas, keeping the corridors clean, insuring the buildings, representing the legal interests. So, for example, when you go to sell your apartment, there's certain documentation that's required for the solicitors when they're doing the conveyance. And so it goes all the way from the legal aspects down to the day-to-day aspects. The responsibility of the property owner then is to pay the service charges, primarily to pay the service charges. And they must, because they're a member of the company, they are bound to all of the company law obligations Relations. It is a company that is set up under the Companies Act, and it will have a minimum of two directors. So the
it's serious stuff. I mean, there's no messing about there, because lots of people will know when they live in an apartment that they have service fees or an annual amount that they have to pay towards that kind of stuff. But if you are a member of that, what rights does that give you? I mean, does it give you voting rights at the AGM, or do you have the right to say, I'm not happy with the way this is done, or the day the bins are collected, or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, it is serious stuff. As I said, it's governed by company law, and company law is one of the largest bodies of law that we have in this country. And what it gives you as a property owner is that it maintains the building that you own. And so, for example, if you own an apartment, what they say is that you own the airspace from the coat of paint outwards, if you like. So the buildings are owned by the management company, the windows, the doors, the structure of the building. And so if anything goes wrong with your apartment, the management company has a legal responsibility to rectify that problem. A water leak, if the front door is broken, to maintain all of the common areas. That comes down as far as if the carpets need to be replaced in the common areas, major renewal and repair. And of course, that brings us then onto the sinking fund. And when we speak about the maintenance of the common areas, we're talking about the overheads to run them. And so we all know in the environment we're in at the moment that construction costs are rising, and they're very high. And that is directly reflective of service charges, because the annual service charge is the payment that a property owner will have to pay every year. And because of the overheads in running, and that, again, that's related to the cost of living. So if you own an apartment, you have to pay the service charge every year. The service charge is determined by what it costs to run the common areas. Mm. It's not determined by what your ability is to pay.
Yeah, and this can be a huge problem, because everybody wants the sinking fund in principle, but in practice it can be really, really expensive. And I'm thinking particularly about people, you know, maybe in two camps: they can't pay or they won't pay. So what happens in those cases? Is the onus on the owner of the apartment to pay, or the tenant?
The onus is on the owner of the apartment to pay, because, of course, the tenant doesn't have any legal contract with the ownership of that unit.
Okay.
And the obligation to the management company arises from the ownership of the unit, and certainly not the tenancy.
So you could have an owner who says, ah, look, I tell with that, I'm not living there. It's none of my business. I don't want to contribute to this because I'm living somewhere else or abroad or whatever. I have the place let out, and they can go and stuff their sinking fund. What happens in that case?
Well, the mechanism to recover outstanding service charges and outstanding sinking fund payments in an owner's management company is the normal debt collection process through the courts. That's problematic for an owner's management company, because the debt that arises in an owner's management company is a different type of debt than many other types of debt. For example, it is added to every year. And because the court process is so slow, it might take a year to recover the debt, in which case it's already been added to and you have to start the process again. The debt collection process isn't ideal, and that's where reform of the Multi-Unit Developments Act comes in, that we are looking to see, can we get something put into the legislation, which is the Multi-Unit Developments Act, that can assist with the debt collection process. When it comes to the individual property owner who decides that he doesn't want to pay, thankfully, we don't get too much of that.
Yeah.
But in the instance that we do, it has a huge impact on an owner's management company compared to anywhere else that that individual decides not to pay.
Yeah,
because in an owner's management, it's collective responsibility.
Yeah, it's collective responsibility. So you can only do maybe some of the gardening or leave, you know, pay for some of the lights to be on. It, can a lien be placed against it in the same way local property tax is, so that if you ever sell it, that it's stacked up as a debt against it? Because we know that with local property tax, you can't sell the building or sell the apartment or the house unless all of that has been paid throughout the years.
Yeah, that can be done. And that's kind of similar to, you know, a judgment on the individual. And so
can it be bought until that's done?
It can't be bought until that's done. So generally how that pans out in practice is that if you're selling your apartment, there is a solicitor for the purchaser, and the solicitor for the purchaser will say, well, my client won't buy it unless there is no debt on it.
Okay.
And so it is by virtue of that conveyancing act that the debt normally gets paid. But yes, it is possible to put a lien on. We don't see it too much in practice.
Okay. All right. Good. Now, for individuals who are interested in maybe being part of that in a bigger way, part of the management company, maybe going on the board. I presume once you're a member, you can go to any AGM that takes place. So what's the next step if you were really invested in this?
Well, the owner's management company operates upon the principle of a collective responsibility arrangement. And because it's a company, it has a minimum of two directors and everybody else is a member of the company. And so the directors are appointed on a voluntary basis. And so because it's voluntary, sometimes it can be difficult to get members to go on as directors. It is an onerous task if we were to look into the detail of the director's duties under company law. And so owners that put themselves forward to go on as directors do so out of a sense of civic duty, and they give of their time freely to the management company.
It's not a paid job.
It most certainly isn't a paid job, and there are issues with it even if it was in some cases. And so it is good for property owners to become directors of the management company, because then they are decision makers and they can affect change in their management company. There are many management companies around Ireland who have difficulties with governance, decision making, practical issues like general maintenance. If you're in one of those management companies and you want to see change, what you want to do is you put yourself on as a director of the management company, you get good decisions made, and you can improve things yourself. And that's why it's a really good idea for property owners to get involved, understand what is involved in the owner's management company, and then you can make change.
Brilliant. Now, and to help to that end, for anybody who wants to do that, you've written a book.
Yes, that's right.
Let me have a look at it now. You brought it in to me. Owner's Management Company Does What It Says on the Tin, Law and Best Practice by Aisling Keenan. And if anybody wants to take a look and decide how to go about that and what to do, or at the very least, just find out more about how you live and where you live and what's available to you, then that would be a great place to start.
And if I could just add to that, Sinead,
sure.
There's lots of help out there with organisations when it comes to owning a unit in a multi-unit development. One of the biggest groups out there that's of huge resources is the Apartment Owners Network. And for any property owners with OMC issues around the country, if you look at the Apartment Owners website, they have really good resources for helping property owners.
Fabulous. All right. Well, Aisling Keenan, thanks a million. Very comprehensive there. And if you're in an OMC, well, look, let us know what problems you have with your buildings. And I presume it covers things, Aisling, just before I finish, things like putting up sky dishes and washing lines and all that kind of thing. That comes in under...
Yeah, it does.
It infuriates people.
It does.
Do you know, they want what they want. They paid an awful lot of money for an apartment and now they find they can't put up a dish or something.
Well, that's right. And for some people who have paid an awful lot of money for an apartment, to see satellite dishes all over the outside of it up next to them as well.
Exactly.
So there are two sides to every story when it comes to communal living and bringing everyone to the same standard and keeping everyone happy.
All right. Okay. Well, listen, thanks a million for joining us on The Home Show.
I'd go to every flea market or yard sale or whatever they had in those days and mosey around. Every time I saw a pair of interesting spectacles and kept them in a box. And as the years passed, the box began to fill up. And by the time I was 18, I had a mini collection. I didn't need glasses. There were no lenses, just the frames. And people looked at me as though I was half nuts. I was really all nuts.
And you're very welcome back to The Home Show. That was a clip of the fabulous Iris Apfel talking about her glassware. And to talk about her now, I'm delighted to welcome back Home of the Year winner Jennifer Sheehan to The Home Show. Jenny, you are a huge fan of Iris.
I mean, who isn't? She's just such an inspiration.
She was fabulous. Now, for people who may be wondering who she is, and actually, folks, like, just Google her there while you're listening, because you'll know her immediately. Yeah. Describe Iris to us, if you can paint a word picture.
And you might, listener, as soon as I start describing, you might go, oh, I've seen that person around. I know who you're talking about. You might not have known her name. So Iris became famous in her 80s, and she was the stunningly stylish elderly woman with short white hair, gigantic black rimmed, usually, or at least thick rimmed glasses, and a huge eclectic collection of necklaces, of bracelets and of patterned wear. very, very iconic and very unique.
She was. And she has died, sadly, at the age of 102.
102.
Now, in all fairness, she's lived what they call a life. No doubt about it. But she started out, Jenny, and the reason we're covering her here is that she started out as a decorator.
Yes. Yeah. So she became famous for her personal style, for her clothes, for her accessories, many of which are on exhibit at various museums around the world. She donated them. But she did start as a decorator. So 102, she was born in 1921 in Queens. And she, her parents were quite stylish, quite artistic. Her dad was in glass and her mother ran her own little clothes store and was, you know, by all accounts, a stylish woman. But her dad, when she was younger, brought her on a project. He was installing mirrors in the home of Elsie DeWolfe, who was this really famous decorator back in 1920s New York. And Iris has the story where Elsie pulled out this bag of samples and her eyes just popped out of her head and she thought, my God, I love this. So she went on to study art. She went to art school in the University of Wisconsin. She did art history as well in New York.
And even at that time, that would have been extraordinarily unusual.
Hugely.
You know, a girl in the 30s going to college to study, you know, something that you know, would have been strange in its own right.
Yeah, a girl from Queens off to study.
Yeah.
And that quite defines her because she has the story of wanting to buy jeans when she was in her early 20s and she was turned away from the shop because ladies don't wear jeans. And they had to order in a special pair of boys' jeans for her because she wouldn't give up. She went back three times and said, I want those pants.
Wow.
And she, you know, for all her style, she loved denim. She said she always wore jeans. I thought that was interesting.
Very interesting. Now, herself and husband Carl were kind of a double act. I mean, first of all, they stayed married throughout all their lives.
He died at 100. So that's a long, long, long marriage.
They were. And they founded this company, which is called Old World Weavers.
Yeah.
Now, talk to me a little bit about that, you know, and their collaboration there.
Yeah, huge. So this, again, was actually driven by Iris, right? So Iris was working as a decorator, a successful decorator, and her husband, Carl, used to come with her sometimes with his toolbox and help hang pictures and shelves and things like that. So one time Iris wanted this pattern that she had in her head. It was this Napoleonic bee. So listeners, if you can imagine, you've seen those bee patterns everywhere, and they're iconic for a reason. Napoleon chose the bee as his emblem of his empire, and she wanted this bee on blue silk for a specific project and she couldn't find it. She ran into a pal of hers from school whose father was a weaver and ran a fabric factory and said, God, that's, you know, I should go and talk to your dad. I should get this made. I should get this design out of my head and get it made. And she did. And it ended up being a hugely successful print for that business. And he said, do you have any more designs in your head that we can turn into hugely successful prints? And she did. And so they did a few more together. And then he approached Iris and her husband, Carl, and said, do you want to go into business together?
Yeah, spotted a genius when he saw one.
Clever guy.
Yeah. And just thought, this is the bit I'm missing from my textile
this
factory.
Is the magic.
A designer. So, so thus she carried on and she went, travelled a lot and sourced lots and lots of different fabrics. So what were the key elements of her kind of style? Now, I know she said once, I don't have any styles because if I did...
She'd have no rules.
No rules.
I would just
break them all. Yeah,
exactly.
But she did actually have a kind of preferences for different types of textures and prints. So talk to me a little bit about, if you were a client of hers, what would you end up with in your house?
What do you want? Well, definitely bold prints, lots of pattern, lots of texture. So when they founded that company, Old World Weavers, you're right, they loved travelling. The two of them used to go off on multiple trips per year to Europe, and they really got into making these reproductions of kind of historical patterns and designs. So you're looking at like silk brocades, geometric, you know, all those kind of African style kind of patterns, everything then from floral to animal print to exotic. The one word that keeps coming to my mind is fantasy. I mean, you know, if you ever see pictures, Grace Spread in Architectural Digest years ago, there's a documentary about her, so you can see her apartment. It's like walking into a fantasy wonderland. So lots of patterns. She had a real appreciation, I would say, for craftsmanship and for quality. She wanted everything done and made in the traditional way that it was made. She had no interest in these mass-produced, you know, crap that she called it from these factories. She wanted everything made. And that's partially why she travelled so much, because she wanted to find where were these fabrics originally made? How were they made? How do we continue that tradition? And she that's what she brought back.
So queen of quality, sustainability, long before it was
time.
A buzzword.
Yeah, and in the true sense of the word, like really, yeah, really very much so. colour, so lots and lots of colour. And if you look at it as well, both her sense of fashion, but also her home style, there was a lot of colour, but she really stuck to a palette within a specific outfit or a specific room. Every room be a different colour on the walls.
Okay, and actually, isn't that key?
Yeah.
Because when you see her, we're talking about Iris Apfel, folks, just in case you're joining us late, it's the iconic designer and model who has died at the age of 102. And Jenny, you're saying that she stuck to a palette. And in fact, that is true, even though you're seeing all the colours of the sun, all the patterns, all the texture. When she wore blue,
yeah,
it was the elements of blue.
Yeah.
She didn't have a kind of a complete mismatch about her.
Yeah, she wasn't just throwing different shades together, different colours. Now, she did have different colours together, but they all, she might have three or four colours on at any one time or more, but they all were very much either tonally linked or, you know, similar shades, or they might have a lot of blue but a pop of yellow here somewhere like that. So she really had a keen eye for colours and how they went together.
So what can we learn from her interiors and from her design concepts? Because she generated these at a time when people had brown furniture, old-fashioned yeah. kind of florals and prints and things. You're talking about pre-war and yeah. maybe post-war there was this clean, quiet look which came in, and really wasn't until the 60s and 70s that people began to experiment with colour and texture in their homes.
Mm.
What can we learn from that avant-garde approach?
I think there's so much in what you're saying. It comes down to the fact that she did not care what anybody else thought. She very much had her own strong individual sense of style. She picked up, you know, pieces of junk, other people might call them, from markets and souks and everything across Europe and everywhere else. And nobody else was buying the stuff. And she wasn't buying it because she wanted to fit in, or she wanted to follow a certain trend, or she wanted to follow a certain style or anything. She just gravitated towards what she liked and got it. And that was the start and end of the thought process, I would say. You know,
yeah.
obviously she had an eye. And I think you can practice that. I think you can practice the eye. So go for what you want, I think is lesson number one.
Okay.
Don't
life lesson there.
Yeah. Life lesson. Go for what you want. Don't worry about anything else. Learn how patterns work. And I think, I mean learn, because she, you know, her first degree was art history, and she spoke often about the history of a pattern, the history of a texture, back to that Napoleonic bee that we mentioned earlier. She knew the history, she knew the background, she knew the context. A lot of that was, I'd say, was from her travels as well, but she was curious and interested in that.
Mm.
And I think there's a lot that soaks in there in terms of why do certain patterns work together? Why do certain maybe period styles, etc., go together? You know, a curiosity behind what you're buying, you know, and not just an initial attraction to how it looks, I think is great.
Now, she took a left turn in her career at the ripe age of 97.
She did.
And she became a model.
She said, she was famously quoted as saying, fashion and interior design are one and the same.
Yeah.
So this is a woman who just couldn't constrain her creative expression, I would say, no matter what. So she became noted, I would say, for her style in at the age around 82, I think she was. She had a friend who was the head of the costume institute in the Met, Harold Coda, and he had this last minute cancellation and needed to fill a gap in his exhibition, and said, I heard Iris has a lot of accessories. And she said, well, come on over to the house and check out what I've got. And he found this treasure trove, rooms upon rooms of all this stuff that she gathered. And that became a hugely successful exhibit. It wasn't even advertised heavily because it was a last minute thing.
Mm.
Word of mouth purely. So Rara Avis, Rare Bird, an Iris Apfel collection in the Met back in 2004. So then she, you know, she became noted, I would say, for her style and quite iconic. And she was signed then, as you said, with IMG Models at the age of 97. Isn't that aspirational?
And she was absolutely fantastic. Never too late, folks, I think is the message here. And Jenny, I suppose one of the other things we can look to her for was this idea now that many, many designers have taken on board as they've pivoted, only kind of made in the last couple of decades, from clothing to interiors. I'm thinking of somebody like Orla Kiley,
yeah.
who I interviewed last year for the home show. We were down in Limerick and she had brought over her new sofa and cushion collection. But it's for her personal style that she's known, and, you know, that pivot, which everybody seems to be doing now from fashion to homewares or homewares to fashion. Paul Costello would be another one.
Yeah.
Do you think she was maybe the instigator for a lot of that?
Potentially she was. But even if you think of, you know, the likes of Gautier, for example, a lot of the big fashion houses in their, you know, their true original era, I would say, also had, you know, homeware ranges, because really what a lot of them were amazing at is fabric. And I think that's probably the core to everything. I mean, that's where the bulk of her career was spent, was in fabric, was in pattern, was in colour, was in the quality of manufacture. And that is not limited to clothes. That's not limited to homewares. You know, that goes beyond everything. I would say that's probably the underpinning of it all. And I think she definitely was at least part of a pioneer group who married those two worlds.
Fantastic. All right. Well, listen, Jenny, you're obviously a fan.
I love her.
So thank you for bringing us up to date on the fabulous Iris Apfel, her life and her history. And maybe we can all learn something from her individual approach to life. And that is all we have time for this week, folks. By the way, green would have been a big colour as we're... Paddy's with Paddy's Day. She actually, there's an awful lot of film of her wearing green with red.
Yeah, she loved green, red. She often wore green eyeshadow. She was big into, she did actually align with Mac. She wore bright, bold, either green or blue eyeshadow.
Fabulous. What could go wrong? Right, yeah. Brilliant. Okay, well, that was Iris Apfel. Jenny, thanks a million. We'll see you next time. You're great. And that's all we have time for now this week. I do hope you enjoyed the mix of guests that we had and the topics we'd cover. If you'd like to suggest any for the future or any guests you'd like me to chat to, well, then please do so. We are available on email at thehomeshow@newstalk.com. You can find me over on Instagram and you can message me there at SineadRyan100. My thanks this week to producer Aidan McKelvey, Marais O'Sullivan, Stephen McClune was on sound, and we will see you all next time on The Home Show podcast.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan. Saturday morning at 8 on Newstalk.